A disconnect with housing resources, the BMV closing offices because of staffing issues, plus an increasingly crowded Republican field for state treasurer, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 10th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, an estimated 93,000 Hoosier households are behind on their rent, yet less than 20% of them have received emergency rental assistance through state and local programs. The Hoosier Housing Needs Coalition says Indiana needs what it calls an all-of-government approach to helping people avoid eviction. Prosperity Indiana's Andrew Bradley says that includes direct community engagement.
To partner with people on the ground, to blanket the hardest-hit areas, knock on doors, get information in hands.
Bradley says the response from the state hasn't been proportional to the problem. He and other housing advocates, for instance, called for a task force on the issue last year, which never happened.
You know, not to be too pointed about it, but have you ever seen Governor Holcomb tweet that emergency rental assistance is available?
Housing remains by far the biggest need that people request help for when they call Indiana 211. Has the government done enough to connect people to housing resources? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, what more should the state be doing?
Well, first of all, if they had done a task force and pointed to a tweet from Governor Holcomb as evidence that they were doing something, I think Ann Delaney's head would explode. So let's not pretend that those were good solutions here. There was a couple weeks ago, Ann noted a $91 million number, and that was actually a number that the state paid to the city of Indianapolis to address an underfunding from the federal government versus the need. So they're trying to rebalance this and put the dollars and the resources where they need to be. 9,000 renters have been helped. They're working with landlords every day, doing outreach with landlords to connect them with tenants who are falling behind, severely falling behind, and at risk of being evicted. They also invested in, like I said, some other parts of the state to expand from 3 months to 12 months the amount of relief that these renters that they have helped would get, which was well beyond what the federal government originally contemplated with this relief. So there's a lot more to do, particularly as we now move beyond enhanced unemployment benefits this past week. And we see hopefully people get back to work, but if people continue to slip with timely rent payments, be able to connect with those people and have an all-government response to this. That was part of the reason the state brought the 211 system itself into state government as opposed to having it as a standalone nonprofit last year, so they could connect people who call into 211 for any reason with all the resources that state government has.
And Delaney, there's only so much the state can do to tell people about what's available. Have they done enough?
They've done virtually nothing. I mean, not just the task force. My husband even had a meeting on this in June, and the state has done virtually nothing. Thank heaven the city is more organized and being able to get that $91 million out where it's needed. But the state is basically incompetent. It's not just in this. You know, if you have unemployment, it takes 7 months to get a hearing, okay? 7 months. I mean, that is incompetence on its face. Now, part of this is the result of the Republican mantra that you have to shrink state government. Well, we've shrunk it, and we've seen what's happened. When it's necessary for them to step in and provide the kind of emergency aid that they could provide, thanks to the federal government putting money in here, they don't have the personnel to do it. They are completely incompetent. I think they should give all the money to the cities and let the cities hand it out, because at least they know what they're doing, in contrast to the state of Indiana.
Nikki Kelly, we saw throughout the pandemic, I think particularly about the Indiana Department of Health, blanketing a message across the state about testing resources, about support, certainly about the vaccines. Once those became available, we saw them use a variety of outlets to do that, even using the emergency broadcast system in some cases to talk about vaccine clinics. Nothing like that certainly has gone on with rental assistance, and yet rental housing needs are the number one need when people call Indiana 211. So has the state's response to this problem been proportional to the scope of it?
I mean, you could certainly argue that we could use some of that money on a, you know, a very comprehensive, you know, awareness education campaign. I do want to point out, though, that, you know, just because 20% have been helped with it, like, I would like to know how many more applied versus who wasn't eligible. Also, most of these programs required the landlord be on board. So you might have a bunch where the person wants the help, but the landlord's like, no, I'm done. I just want them out. So, you know, it's not as easy as just they don't know it's there. There could be other reasons they're not being helped.
The housing advocates talked about an all-of-government approach to this, John Schwanes. How big a role, and we've talked a little bit about this on the show, but how big a role does the court system have to play in making sure that people are getting connected to resources?
Well, I think it does play an important role because in many cases it's sort of the last guardrail or the last safety valve before people are in fact evicted and put out on the streets. And there are places across the country where courts have essentially set up assistance operations one or two doors down the hall so that somebody who's appearing before a judge and meets the various criteria for assistance programs is told by the judge, yeah, just two doors down and we'll start the process there. That's not happening everywhere. But again, this is a mess. But it's a mess just about everywhere. It proves that government isn't very good, I guess, at giving out money. I guess it's better at perhaps collecting money. It's used to collecting taxes, but distributing it in a short time frame in this kind of manner is more difficult. And it is everywhere. So I don't know what the answer is. A few jurisdictions have focused on the property owners and landlords so that they say, we know who you are. Do you have multiple tenants who are behind in their rent? If so, let's put 10 or 20 of them together and put through an assistance scheme that helps those individuals rather than doing it on a one-by-one basis on behalf of the tenants who are behind. So, again, is that the answer? There is no one answer. It is probably, to a certain extent, a government, all aspects of government on board.
All right. Well, the housing crisis certainly isn't new. And it's not going away anytime soon, so my guess is we'll be talking about this again at some point. But beginning this week, 11 Bureau of Motor Vehicle offices throughout the state will be closed until October 2nd due to staffing shortages. Staff at those offices are being reassigned because the agency has had trouble filling 60 to 80 positions. Adding to that, anywhere between 10 to 15% of the workforce is consistently out due to COVID-19 precautions. BMV Chief Operating Officer Kevin Garvey says the agency had to decide between temporarily closing a few offices and keeping wait times down, or keep all the offices open but make Hoosiers wait through long lines.
I would rather make these small temporary closures and provide more Hoosiers with the type of experience that they're used to getting from us.
Garvey says the agency is having to compete for workers as many employers have started to raise their wages. He argued that despite having a starting wage at around $13.50 an hour, the state may offer benefits like health care and pensions that similar employers don't. Ann Delaney, we've talked before about the worker shortages, certainly, but this is the first time we're talking about it in relation to the operation of government itself. So how significant an issue does some temporary closures really present?
Well, I don't think it's going to be only the temporary closures. The problem in Indiana has been that under the Republicans, they don't value state employees. They don't concern themselves with state employees. We have thousands of state employees in Indiana who are making less than half the median federal income. Less than half. And this BMV person talks about $13.50 as if it's a great wage. You know, it's not. You can make more than that at Buffalo Wild Wings. And on top of that, you can get benefits. And no young person starting out is worried about retirement, okay? Benefits and salary are what drive it. And we're not going to get anybody that, frankly, we would want to have at $13.50 an hour. And thank heaven those wages are going up. They've been stagnant in this state for way too long, so I'm happy they're going up. But the state has to catch up. We've got to offer competitive wages, and $13.50 is not where it's at.
Mike O'Brien, we've talked about the private sector responding to worker shortages, and one of the things we've said is, you know, employers will respond to worker shortages in part sometimes by raising wages. Does the state need to do the same thing?
They're going to have to if they want to compete. This isn't just a problem with the BMV. It's a problem across state government, but it's a problem because we have record openings. I mean, we can make it anecdotal. I mean, everyone watching this right now or listening is experiencing this every day, whether it's at, you know, service that they get at a, you know, anything in the service industry right now is suffering. With enhanced unemployment going away, hopefully that we see an uptick in these positions being filled. The state paid out unemployment benefits in the last 18 months to 881,000 Hoosiers, $9.2 billion worth. And a lot of these people were making a lot more money not working, and we aligned the incentives to stay at home, and that was necessary for public health for a time, and it's not anymore. Because there are ways that we now know through vaccination and other ways to keep people safe. So the president this week coming out and starting to hammer employers for employees making the personal decision to not get vaccinated is a wonderment to me. The incentives have got to be aligned for people to want to get vaccinated and have incentives. And there is all the incentives again are aligned. Scratch off lottery tickets notwithstanding, for them to go do that and get back to work.
I'll just note for our audience that we will be talking about the Biden vaccine mandate a lot more next week on the show. We're getting reporters in Indiana Public Broadcasting and gathering feedback from state leaders on that issue today and then through next week. So we'll talk more about that next week. But Nikki Kelly, on the BMV issue, you looked at the salaries. You got some salary information from the BMV on this. Do you think it is an attractive position in terms of that salary and benefits kind of package?
Well, hey, I was trying to talk my daughter into applying. So, I mean, the $13.50 is the lowest, you know, the very base. They obviously go up from there depending on duties and responsibilities. And yeah, you got to look at that insurance, got to look at the paid holidays they get. You know, that's a lot that, you know, if you work at Buffalo Wild Wings, you're not getting paid holidays. That's for sure. So I think there are some, you know, it's more than just money. So hopefully some people will now realize these are open and they can apply.
On the issue, though, John Schwannis, of trying to stay competitive in the marketplace, if the state does have to look at raising salaries, not just at the BMV, but across state government for employees, do you think that lawmakers are ready to open the purse strings for that sort of thing?
They don't want to, certainly. I mean, this is a group of individuals who pride themselves on shepherding the state in a very frugal manner and being very frugal with tax dollars. But that only goes so far. You have to function as a state government, and there are certain parts of state government where it might be invisible to the public when there is a shortage of staffing. This is not one of those. This is one of those nexus points where the state of Indiana and state government interacts on a regular basis with Hoosiers in a very hands-on fashion. So Hoosiers would notice, the complaints would start, the phones would ring, the mailboxes would fill, the email inboxes would fill, and lawmakers would ultimately go along. They have no choice.
I just wanted to follow up one quick thing. Is a lot of people who reached out to me are concerned that these temporary closures will end up being full-time, that the state will say, hey, that worked out pretty well. This way we can save some money.
Well, stay tuned certainly on that. The time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Icemiller email and text alerts. This week's question: is the average Indiana state government employee underpaid? A, yes, or B, no. Now, last week we asked you if you think the U.S. Supreme Court will overturn legalized abortion. Now, I asked that same question 2 months ago, and 2 months ago, just 22% of you said yes. Now, 36% of you have said yes, 64% have said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR. And look for the poll. Well, the city clerk of Fort Wayne has joined a growing list of Republican candidates vying to become the next Indiana state treasurer about 9 months before the major state political parties will choose the nominees at their state conventions. The 2022 race for state treasurer is expected to be a crowded one, at least on the GOP side, as current treasurer Kelly Mitchell is term limited, unable to run again. The 2022 race for state treasurer is expected to be a crowded one, at least on the Republican side, as current treasurer Kelly Mitchell is term limited, unable to run again. Fort Wayne's Lana Kiesling is now the fourth GOP candidate to announce their campaign. Kiesling, a former small business owner, has been city clerk since 2015. The other candidates vying to become the Republican nominee, Morgan County Republican Party leader Daniel Elliott, former George W. Bush administration spokesperson Pete Seat, and Susie Jaworski, a top official at the Department of Energy under President Donald Trump. No Democrat has announced their candidacy. Nikki Kelly, how concerning is it for Democrats not to have a candidate yet?
I don't think it's a worry. I mean, we're pretty far away from a summer convention. And to be honest, you're not going to have two candidates. So really the only reason to get in early is to, you know, fight it out amongst your precinct committeemen to try to get their vote in convention. So I'd say they'll probably have someone by the end of the year, and that's probably fine.
Yeah, John Schwannis, it's been, I think it's either 1980 or 1976, I think, the last time that a Democrat won the state treasurer's race. So it's obviously a lot more competitive on the Republican side anyway. So does the number of candidates in the Republican field at this point make sense?
Is this a quiz? Is that Tom New, by the way? Did I get bonus points for
Jack New.
Jack was dad. You want a history on this? Jack worked in the Welsh administration.
Tom, his son,
actually was the treasurer.
There we go.
You can look it up. But the father-son team. Did I pass the credit? Did I get the test?
Yeah, that was it.
But it's, you know, it is, I don't know if it's surprising that so many people would line up for this job. We stipulated a moment ago that salaries in state government are not great. And that applies certainly to rank and file workers, but it's not going to get anybody rich, even if you're an elected office holder. You could make more in the private sector. So people see this perhaps as a stepping stone to higher office. But I think if you look at history, it doesn't necessarily turn out that way. But people keep trying, and I guess there's something to be said for being in the limestone, in the state government, in the heart of it all. Democrats will get somebody eventually. It won't be an empty spot on the ballot.
Mike O'Brien, somebody posed this question to me this week in light of the news that there's another Republican candidate, and it was that, does the political party of the Indiana state treasurer matter?
Doesn't the administration of the office, when it comes time for the general election, though, these administrative offices, whether including attorney general, they tend to follow the baseline of it reflects the base of the party and where it's at, where it is in that state. Democrats had a hard time finding the candidate for lieutenant governor in 2020. They had to change the rules and expand the time frame to convince somebody to step into that role. So I don't know. I don't know that we're going to see a candidate for treasurer before the end of the year. We may see it the week of the convention or at the convention when they finally, whoever shows up last at the, meeting is tapped to be the treasurer candidate. But typically these follow the outcome of the election. I think the closest one we've had in recent memory was in 2006, which was a great year for Democrats nationally and a really tough year for Republicans in Indiana, probably the last tough one we had.
And Delaney, sort of Mike just talked about, we might not see a treasurer candidate on the Democratic side until very close to the convention. Is that just a reflection of how tough this race will be for a Democrat statewide?
It's a reflection of the fact that this office is ministerial, okay? It's not important at all. The only thing, the reason you have so much competition among the Republicans is that Kelly Mitchell showed them that you can use it to reward your friends and raise money. And, they're now thinking, well, maybe this isn't such an unimportant office after all. We'll have a candidate for treasurer. But, frankly, this, like attorney general and like secretary of state, should all be appointed offices. They really should. It's a waste of money to have them on the ballot.
All right. Well, a study looking at school choice in Indiana suggests that competition spurred by vouchers limits public school performance over time. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports the study focuses on voucher participation and private school density around public schools and uses 8 years of state school choice and test performance data.
Yusuf Chanbolat is a doctoral student at Indiana University and is the researcher behind the study. He says findings suggest private school competition lowers public schools' proficiency rates over time.
In the long term, competition harms public schools due to the departure of those relatively high-achieving students.
He says that's one reason why it's vital for policymakers to consider the context school choice works within, especially because of income and other disparities among different groups of people. But Chanbolat says more research is needed about how the loss of high-achieving students affects classrooms, too.
John Schwannis, realistically, does data like this change anything about voucher policy in Indiana?
I'm not so sure it does. Fans are going to remain fans. Detractors will remain detractors. I'm sure it's a fine study, and I'm glad there is research providing data for decision makers. But this is the kind of thing where I think most people would have drawn the same conclusion, even in the absence of a study, because you have a set number of students. Some of them have the parents who are motivated to get them in another program. They leave. The money goes with them. And left behind are those perhaps who, for whatever reason, aren't aware of those options, aren't motivated to get those options, or in many cases have special needs that prohibit them from passing tests that would allow them to gain admission to private schools. And public schools don't have the option of saying, we're sorry, we don't want you in our school, you don't meet our standards. We are obligated, of course, to train you. So smaller pool, less money. I think we kind of could assume this was the outcome.
When Indiana's voucher school law was created, and certainly in the years since, it's been billed as it's good for students, it's good for parents, and it's good for schools because it will force more competition for public schools across the board having to compete with private schools. Nikki Kelly, does this study seem to undercut that? But again, does that matter even if it does?
I don't think it matters. And I agree with John. This is not a shocking thing. This is, I think, likely the result of what happens, which is that they can cherry pick. That's the whole point. They can cherry pick the students that they think will do better in private schools. So if you take some of the people with the higher test scores out, then obviously their proficiency overall of who remains in the public school is going to drop.
I think one of the most interesting things from that study is that the students that use the vouchers and move don't improve their performance, which was the rationale behind this. It was going to take students from poor performing schools, remember, failing schools where the building is getting an F or something, some crazy thing they came up with, and move them into schools where they were going to do so much better. And the fact of the matter is, they're not doing any better. So the whole system is built on a house of cards.
That's not right. I mean, because you're taking kids out of a poor performing school and put them in a better performing school. And if they were a B student before, they're a B student in an environment that's more challenging. It's the whole point performing school. So I agree with John that
they're not performing
all of this
any better.
Out. The answer
they're not performing
isn't a kill
any
choice
better
these
on
kids
the...
in failing schools. It's to improve the failing
schools.
They're
not performing any better on the standard tests that you guys talk about as being all important on performance. That's the measure. It's not the letter B. It's the testing. And they're not doing any better.
All right. Well, finally, Indiana's Division I FBS football teams got off to a mostly good start last week. Purdue, Ball State, and Notre Dame all won, the latter in a squeaker against Florida State. But the Hoosiers lost in a drubbing by Iowa. However, the most viral moment of the game came from an image shared by IU initially of one of the Hoosier football players' jerseys, which read not Indiana across the chest, but Indania, I suppose is how you would pronounce it. Ann Delaney, should that first loss of the season count since clearly Indiana didn't lose, but Indania did?
No. Yeah, doesn't count at all. I just feel sorry for whoever put that jersey together because heads are going to roll, and I think Indiana's performance going forward is going to be much, much better.
Yeah,
I
Mike.
Forget the entire experience.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien,
exactly.
Are you expecting, I think, you know, high hopes for IU this season? Are you expecting things to improve on that front?
God, I hope so. I think the Notre Dame game might wind up being the best game of the season. right out of week one. That was it shouldn't have been a good game, but it wound up that way, and I'm glad it went the way it did. Notre Dame won.
I mean, Nikki, at this point, you know, that image was so popular, maybe not for the reason IU hoped, but, I mean, should they just change the jerseys for 1 week to Indonesia just for fun?
Yeah, probably not. And you mentioned the person who put the jersey together not noticing, but also, like, you know, a person
put
saw
it on
the picture and decided to tweet it without noticing.
Yeah, that was tweeted. That was originally tweeted by the IU Hoosiers Twitter account, but, you know, long for the days of copy editors, I suppose.
We'll see how Idaho is spelled. I will be in the stands, and I'm predicting
that
Indonesia or Indiana, whatever, will kick Idaho's butt.
So. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please get vaccinated if you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.